Ray, I'm gonna play a video clip for you, and I wanna know your take on this video clip.
I don't know if you've seen this. I don't want to blindside you with this. This is the latest statement, latest tweet, as you were just saying, President-elect's latest unsolicited pronouncement on the intelligence community. This was his tweet just a little while ago tonight. You see the scare quotes there. Intelligence briefing on so-called Russian hacking was delayed until Friday. Perhaps more time needed to build a case. Very strange. We're actually told, intelligence sources tell NBC News, since this tweet has been posted, that actually this intelligence briefing for the president-elect was always planned for Friday. It hasn't been delayed. But he's taking these shots, this antagonism, taunting to the intelligence community.
You take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday of getting back at you. So even for a practical, supposedly hard-nosed businessman, he's being really dumb to do this.
What do you think the intelligence community would do if they were motivated?
I don't know, but from what I'm told, they are very upset with how he has treated them and talked about them. And we need the intelligence community. We don't know what's going on. Look at the Russian hacking. Without the intelligence community, we wouldn't have discovered it.
Your takeaway.
Nima, this is really good that you picked that clip, because it's pregnant with meaning. I gave a speech on the 60th anniversary of President John Kennedy's assassination. And the main conclusion to be drawn from that is that there were people within our government that did him in, because he was reaching out to the Russians for a more decent relationship. He was pulling troops out of Vietnam. He was doing all manner of things toward peace that what we have called the deep state didn't want. Now, I hold no brief for Donald Trump. My wife always says, look, Ray, always tell people what you think about Donald Trump. I think he was one of the worst presidents ever, okay? But the truth is the truth, okay? The Democrats, assisted ably by John Brennan, the head of the CIA, and James Comey, head of the FBI, did all they could to help Hillary win and to help Trump lose. They did all manner of extra legal and downright illegal things. Okay. Oh my God. And Trump won anyway. Okay. So the rest of the time was spent to cover up what they had done. They had done that under a false premise. Comey, in his book, he says, and I quote, I was operating in an environment where Hillary Rodham Clinton was sure to be the next president of the United States, end quote. Well, if you're operating in that kind of environment, and you want to become attorney general, or you want to stay in your place as a powerful head of the CIA, and you don't have to worry about being indicted or convicted for crimes, well, you take all kinds of liberties with the truth. And so was born Russiagate, brainchild of Jacob Sullivan and Hillary Clinton. And we know from court testimony that Hillary Clinton blessed the most blatant operation, which tied Trump and his people to Alpha Bank, Alpha Bank in Russia. It was concocted out of whole cloth. This was October 2016. It's worth just mentioning that the technical people who were asked to falsify these internet exchanges said to the Clinton campaign, look, any technically apt people will be able to discover what we did in about 2 or 3 days. And the Clinton people said, 2 or 3 days. The election's in 2 or 3 days. Forget about it. That was just one example. Another example is that Obama was in this up to his neck. Russia hacking? Well, he encouraged the head of intelligence, James Clapper, and the head of the Department of Homeland Security, what's it, Jay Johnson, to put out a paper on Russian hacking before they had a report. from the people doing the forensics. I said, hurry up with the report. Hurry up. No, we'll go with it anyway. Okay. So the supreme irony here is that Trump lost. Now, what are they going to do about it? Blame it on Russia. Okay. Blame the hacking on Russia. Divert attention from what was in the hacking. And for those of you who don't remember, those hacked emails from Clinton and from the Democratic National Committee showed graphically how the DNC had tilted the playing field to the point where Bernie Sanders didn't have a chance. And to his discredit, Bernie Sanders knew that and wouldn't stand up for his own rights. Okay. So anyhow, that's why these things had to be concealed. That's why they had to, well, divert attention to it because of the Russians, the Russians, the Russians. Now, so Trump wins November 2016. The deep state is at work. Now, Rachel Maddow is an honorary member of the deep state. I mean, she certainly has earned it. Okay, she takes this stuff from the CIA, and so does Chuck Schumer, and from the FBI, and they act as their, well, we won't say agents, because I don't think the CIA or the FBI pays them, okay? But they're what we call agents of influence. So you're going to have to pay those guys. Okay, so what happens? They say, well, we have to put Trump in his place. He's a real estate guy from New York. He doesn't know how Washington works. We have to tell him. And so Schumer calls up Rachel Maddow and says, hey, I like about 5 minutes, 10 minutes on your show tonight. She, oh, okay. Do you have something good there, Chuck? You're going to love this. I'll send you some email first so you know, you can prime the pump. Okay. So you see her. She says, wow, they're taking on the intelligence community. And Schumer says, very dumb. I thought he was a smart businessman. But the intelligence community has six ways to Sunday to get back at you. So this is really dumb. You know, we need the intelligence community. We really need these guys because otherwise we wouldn't know about the Russian hacking. The non-existent Russian hacking, which Jacob Sullivan and John Brennan and James Comey pushed, okay? So in retrospect, the thing is not only a stern warning to Trump, say, look, you know, this is not New York real estate. This is a tougher game here. And if you cross the intelligence community, you're going to pay the price. And he did. He wasn't able to do a damn thing with respect to Russia because of all this misinformation on Russian hacking. Now, I think I may have mentioned this to your viewers before, but it's worth mentioning again. We know that when CrowdStrike, the cyber firm that was delegated by James Comey of the FBI to do the forensics on the DNC emails, why didn't the FBI do that themselves, I wonder? Well, anyhow, CrowdStrike, led by this guy, Sean Henry, who worked for the FBI for 20 years, okay? So he was not a, well, anyhow, he looked into it. And whereas Obama insisted they put out a report even before CrowdStrike, Sean Henry reported, well, they did put out a report. And the report was under testimony on the 5th of December, 2017. That would be 6 years ago. Next week, what did Sean Henry say? He said, Adam Schiff, the co-chair at that, or the deputy chair at that time, says, Mr. Schiff, you did the forensics on the DNC. When was it that the Russians hacked into there, and how did they do it? And Sean Henry starts going, well, you know, and his lawyer pulls him apart and says, I'm under oath. Well, Mr. Schiff, there is no technical evidence at all that the Russians hacked into the DNC emails. Matter of fact, there's no technical evidence that anyone hacked into the DNC emails. Oh, how come 95% of Americans don't know that? Because Adam Schiff took over the committee and put it in the bottom drawer of his safe and changed the combination. Okay. How long was he able to hide it? 2.5 years. Now, somebody told President Trump, hey, Mr. President, you're president, you know, so you could get those, you could get that testimony released. And he said, I can? He said, well, get a new director of national intelligence in there that's working for you, not for anyone else, okay? And tell him to call Schiff, and this is what happened. The new national intelligence director called Schiff and said, look, Adam, you know, it's really unconscionable that you've kept this under wraps for 2.5 years, okay? The date was May 7th, 2020, if you're making notes, okay? But Adam, sorry, but I'm going to release this tomorrow unless you do. So Schiff hurriedly releases it. He puts it in a stack of other documents of no particular worth, 57. So it's disguised, and nobody reports on this. The New York Times had it, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. They had it on the 7th of May, 2020. So the major media has suppressed this story for 3.5 years, going 1 year better than Adam Schiff. And so next week, on the 5th of December, that testimony will be 6 years old, and nobody knows about it. So what am I saying here? I'm saying that looking back at what Schumer said, you know, if it weren't for the Intelligence Committee, we wouldn't know about Russian hacking. Of course not. They made it all up. And they made a lot of other stuff up. And my point is simply that when a new president comes in, you know, I used to think this was a little strange, but it was all borne out when Trump came in and said, well, look, we got to do a job on this guy. He's got to learn his place. And the best way to do that, of course, put Schumer on Rachel Maddow and say, you know, and say, don't be dumb. Don't cross the intelligence community. And then I'll say just one more time. I wish it were funny, you know, him ending up, we wouldn't find out about the Russian hacking. Well, it's not funny. It's consequential. You know, what I like to say now is simply that, why is it consequential? Well, because most Americans still believe it, okay? And what does that mean? That means that Putin is responsible for Donald Trump in the minds of most Americans, that Putin is the devil incarnate, that the press has made Putin into another Hitler, supported by Hillary Clinton, who has called him Hitler. And if the U.S. starts losing, I'm sorry, if Ukraine starts losing with U.S. support in Ukraine, okay, against the Russians, well, what happens then? Well, even though our president has said that no problem, Russia has already lost this war, and the head of the CIA has said, you know, not only has Russia lost, but the ineptitude of the Russian military has been laid bare for the whole world to see. Delusional, okay? So who's won? Russia has won. So put yourself in the position of Biden, Blinken, Jacob Sullivan, Nuland, all these people that made up all this stuff in 2016, and it's all on the record now. Now, if they lose in Ukraine, my God, they will lose the election. And if they lose the election, they could lose their freedom. There's a lot of stuff in the courts already, in emails that have been unimpeachable, to show that Biden and his son have been bribed, been taking bribes, his whole family really, That Jacob Sullivan was responsible for Russiagate, all this stuff that John Brennan was too with these Russian hacking, and, you know, Tony Blinken. When I found out that in order to help Biden win the election in 2020, and this terrible, terrible stain on the Biden name came out, namely Hunter's laptop, with all manner of lascivious and just profane, terrible stuff on it. And, you know, hints that Biden and his son were taking bribes from Ukrainians and from Britain. Said, what are you going to do? This is 3 weeks before the election. Well, they closed down the story. They took the Washington, the New York Post, the oldest surviving newspaper in the country, off Twitter. It was blacked out. Okay. And then they said, that's not enough because, oh, there's going to be a debate between Trump and Biden, and oh God, Trump's going to ask him about this. So Tony Blinken calls up his old friend from the CIA, a fellow named Mikey Morrell, President Bush's briefer on all those weapons of mass destruction. Remember, okay. Mikey Morrell. He says, Mike, can you get a whole bunch of former intelligence directors to say that this is a Russian disinformation operation? And Mikey Morrell says, sure, when do you need that? 3 days, because the debate's coming up in about 5 days. Okay, so Mikey Morrell goes to it. 2 days, he's got 50 former intelligence directors, three or four of them former directors of the CIA. And Mikey Morrell, you're 51, right? And what do they say? They say, this bears all the earmarks of a Russian intelligence disinformation operation. So Biden goes to the last debate with Trump. And as predicted, anybody would predict it, Trump asks about, what about your son's laptop? And Biden says, oh, you didn't know? 50 former intelligence directors have declared that to bearing all the earmarks of a Russian disinformation operation. Mr. Trump, didn't you know that? Next question, please. Now, did that help Biden win the election? I imagine it did. Can I prove that it made the big difference? No, nobody can prove that. But this is the kind of stuff that these guys were demonstrably guilty of. So, a long way of saying, if I'm Biden, if I'm Blinken, if I'm Sullivan, you know, I have a personal stake in not losing in Ukraine, not losing the election, not losing my freedom. And so what am I going to do? These guys are crazy. The thing that I worry about is them using a mini nuke, just a small little, only half the size of the ones we used in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Just a mini nuke. That'll show the Russians that we can do it. And the American people, having been sensitized to how bad the Russians are, they'll support us. Now, do I rule that out? I don't rule that out. I'm deathly afraid of that. And one other thing I just mentioned here, this is November. Now, I was still briefing down in the White House 40 years ago. And in November of 1983, it came very close to you, Nima, and I being incinerated with the rest of the world. How so? Well, people in the White House decided, we'll have a big command exercise, nuclear exercise. We'll do it real big this time. We'll have part of it in Seyfert. We'd have part of a blackout in communications. And we'll have the president himself and the vice president included in this. Now, the Russians are smart enough. They had intelligence good enough to see what was happening. And they thought it was the real thing. Okay. How do we know that? well, we have pretty good sources in Russia at the time. We know that Andropov, who was in charge then, was really afraid this was the real thing. It bore all the earmarks. We even went to DEFCON. We upped the alert status of our forces. So what happened? This is a really interesting thing here. Some of my friends, including a young man, young at the time, Mel Goodman, okay? He worked for me way back in the 70s. He had the guts as a division chief in the Soviet division to go to Bobby Gates. He was deputy director at the time. You may know him as Robert M. Gates, who was Secretary of Defense later. He went to Gates. He said, look, this is the Russians are panicking, okay? They're getting their own nuclear weapons in. We got to do something. And Gates says, come on, don't be. They're making believe they're afraid. So Goodman, to his credit, and a couple others, went to Casey, Gates' boss, Bill Casey, and said, Mr. Casey, we hate to interrupt you here, but it looks like we're going to have a nuclear war on our hands unless you tell those guys in the White House, look, knock it off. So they knocked Ronald Reagan out of the loop for the stuff, and they tamped it down, okay? We also heard from a Russian spy that the British were running, that this the KGB thought this was the real thing, too. So just in time. Now, how do we all survive that? Exactly. Well, it's exactly 40 years ago this month, November, okay? But we survived that because somebody had the guts to say, look, you have to take the Russians seriously when you have technical evidence they've gone to full alert, okay? They're really worried about that. We have Gordievsky, the spy that the Russians are running. He's saying the same thing. For God's sake, stop it. Gates wouldn't stop it. Casey took these guys, took my friends down to the White House, and they said their case, and they knocked it off. Thank God, okay? Now, I mention that because there's a connection here. The nuclear issue is really big because it's the only thing we got. Okay, look at these Blinken and Sullivan. They don't know nothing about military stuff. So they said, well, we run out of shells for the 155 millimeter howitzers and artillery. So we give them, you know, we give them this scatter sort of stuff that will kill everybody within, you know, radius of, whatever. And then what are you going to do when you run out of that? Well, maybe depleted uranium shells in our tanks, and that will help, right? Yeah, that'll help a lot for Ukrainians who survive. So what's the next step? The next step is a mini nuke. And do I put it past them? No, I don't. Do I think it's likely? No. But the very fact that I think it's possible bothers me to death. So this is a kind of progression, as I see. These guys are tied in with this know-it-all deep state, and they don't know it all, and they're running things. None of them have worn a uniform except that fellow Austin, who's really, you know, has worked for Raytheon, and she's, you know, this really good for business in Raytheon. So you have a situation that I've never seen the likes of before. The last thing I'll say is simply that the president, let's face it, he's non-compos mentis. He's not completely there. You can see when he stands on a stage and he picks his nose and he flicks it at the Malaysian foreign minister. You know, he can't find his way off the stage. So I'm Vladimir Putin, right? Or I'm Xi Jinping. And I'm looking at this. I'm saying, my God. We have to keep our powder dry. Let's you and I not act irresponsibly. What I'm going to do, says Putin in Ukraine, is just a trit. I'm not going to go to the Dnieper River right now. I don't want to force them to use mini nukes. Okay, and you just keep your powder dry out there in the Pacific. They're not going to really be able to hurt you militarily. So don't. Don't threaten them too much. Try to deal with them. And so bottom line for me is I know something about Soviet leaders. I've been watching them closely for many decades now. I've learned something about Chinese leaders as well. And I think we're damn lucky to have people secure in their own positions, thinking rationally, and being advisedly worried about what Biden might be prompted to do on the advice of people like Blinken and Sullivan themselves, at some peril, at some some chance of being indicted, prosecuted, if they lose the election, and if somebody like Trump comes in, again, well, no brief for Trump, but it's a pretty vengeful guy, isn't he? That said, if I were Blinken, Sullivan, those guys, I would be really, really worried what will happen. And so there's this deep, deep personal aspect to this. And, that goes for Gaza as well. We can't let our Israeli friends lose. It's a very, very volatile situation, Nima. Thanks for letting me comment at this length, but that's the way I put that together.
My pleasure, Ray. But let's talk about the Lloyd Austin's visit to Kiev. In your opinion, what was the reason behind this trip? Was he trying to convince Zelensky, his administration, to go after negotiations? Or, as we saw, he was there to announce that the EU is going to support Ukraine, going to send funds and weapons more and more to Ukraine?
Good question, Nima. I would say he was there to ostensibly support Ukraine. What I remember, something like $100 million peanuts. not for us, but for Raytheon and the Defense Department. Peanuts, okay? So here's Austin, who a half year ago said, "We are very hopeful that Ukraine will win. We have given them 90% of what they need to win. So let's see what happens in this counteroffensive," says Austin. Well, if there's any honesty left in this man at all, what he says to Zelensky is, "Look, we gave you everything that General Zelensky asked for. We give everything that you asked for, 90% of it. And it didn't win. So we're not going to be able to give you any more, as much as I dearly love to, because I don't control money. Congress controls the money, and they're not going to do it. We had some 155 millimeter shells to give you, and the Congress decided, well, no, we'll give those to our closer friends in Israel. So we don't have anything to give you. You ought to make a deal. And if you don't make a deal," says Austin to his opposite number, Zelensky, defense minister, "you don't make a deal, we're not going to be able to support you. And we wonder whether this guy you work for, what's his name, Zelensky, whether he really should be around anymore. We know he's got some villas in around the world, so that might be one way to achieve this." Okay. So then, at the same or about time, the head of CIA, Bill Burns, goes to Kiev. And what does he do? I could tell you, but then they'd kill me, right? I don't know what he did, but you can figure out what he's doing. He says, "Well, you guys really haven't won now, like we hoped, like we gave you all the stuff to 90%. So what are you going to do now? Zelensky, you're not going to get back Crimea. You're not going to get back these other four provinces. So maybe you ought to make a deal now before you lose even more provinces to the east of the Dnieper River." And that's quite possible. It is quite possible that in this attrition of war that Putin is pursuing, they could go and take a couple more of those oblasts, a couple of those provinces, right up to the Dnieper River. I would fully expect them to do that if there's not some sensible resort to negotiation. So That's how I look at the situation there. It's really over. I mean, the Ukrainians have no shells. They have some weapons, but no shells. Weapons aren't really good without the shells, right? Okay. And they have, 17-year-olds to people almost as old as me, name it, for God's sake, going into the fray. I feel sorry for them because everyone wants to defend their country, right? And they've been subjected to the same propaganda that we have. So, you destroy 500,000 Ukrainians for what? To weaken Russia? Russia is demonstrably stronger now, and they're building up the kind of army that will prevent Ukraine or anyone else from threatening what they perceive to be the threats there back in when they started the special military operation. The other thing should be mentioned in this regard is that there have been lots of reports that the Russians really had limited aims in going into Ukraine, okay? Now, what's one evidence of that? Well, they were accused of wanting to take over Ukraine, right? Well, you don't do that with 90,000 troops. So they go up toward Kiev and they stop. And what happens? They're in negotiations right off the bat. A week after the special military operation started, the Russians made it clear they're willing to talk. And the Ukrainians said, okay, let's talk. They started talking in Minsk, in Belarus. And then gradually those talks progressed to taking place in Istanbul. Okay. And we know this because the Turkish foreign minister was there and attests to it. We know this because the Israeli prime minister, Bennett, previous prime minister, was involved in this. We know from other sources, from Schröder in Germany, that he was asked to help mediate. In other words, we know that there was this agreement reached. What was the agreement? Well, the agreement was what the Russians were asking for all the time. No admission to NATO. Ukraine prosperous, but neutral. Zelensky agreed to that on the 29th, 30th of March. It was initialed. Now, by whom was it initialed? We know his name now. His name is Arakhmakhia. Now, who's he? A good friend of Zelensky, part of his political party. He was the negotiator. Okay? I mean, he's not a rival of Zelensky. He's not trying to play political game. He negotiated this thing. And he says that it was a done deal, that the Russians decided to withdraw from around Kiev, and the rest of the deal was neutrality and no membership, of course, in NATO. Now, how does that square with the NATO narrative, the NATO legend? Well, up until a month ago, actually 6 weeks ago, the NATO legend was this attack on Ukraine had nothing to do with NATO enlargement. Nothing at all. Putin just using that as a pretext, right? So then what happens is Stoltenberg. Now, he's a handsome guy, and he's very useful to the United States. He gets up, and in some delusionary way, before the EU Parliament says, oh, yes, we know is that the Russians didn't want NATO enlargement. And so they said, if you enlarge NATO, we will invade Ukraine. And we said, no, we will not agree not to. And so he invaded Ukraine. Now, isn't that funny? Because instead of no enlargement of NATO, he got Finland and maybe Sweden. And so he invaded and he still got NATO enlargement. Now, that was a faux pas grande, because the whole narrative was nothing to do with, well, it did have to do with NATO enlargement. And so that was 6 weeks ago. Now we have not only Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister of Israel. Yeah, we've got Schröder, former chancellor of Germany. We've got the Turks who are there at the negotiations. And now we have the Ukrainian negotiator who initialed the agreement, went back to Kiev and said, hey, look what I did. That we could get the Russians out of here. All we have to do is agree to be neutral, agree not to join NATO. What happened? The U.S. said no. The U.S. sent one of its little satraps, one of its little marionettes to Kiev, Boris Johnson. And he said, no, you can't do this because we won't support you anymore, okay? And you may think this is a good deal, but we don't think this is a good deal. And the question, of course, is why? Well, because this is not about Ukraine. This is about weakening Russia. We think that if we can draw Russia in more, we can give them a bloody nose, and we can prove, as Bill Burns said just 2 months ago, we can prove that the Russian army is inept, and we can lay that bare to the whole world. There's a lot of delusion going on. We thought Bill Burns might be the adult in the room, but he's just a cog in the bureaucratic machine. Matter of fact, it was he that was warned specifically by Sergei Lavrov, who had just been appointed foreign minister of Russia back in 2008. He was warned by Lavrov, look, Mr. Burns, nyet means nyet. If you allow NATO, if you know, allow Ukraine into NATO, you will provoke us, because there will be civil war for sure in Ukraine, and we will have to decide whether we need to intervene or not. That's in the cable. And if I've seen one cable from Embassy Moscow, tens of thousands, okay, as my job of chief of the Soviet foreign policy branch in CIA. So there you go, you know. Provoke, you're going to provoke us. So what does Bill Burns say now as head of the CIA? He's become a propagandist. He says, this war was unprovoked. Unprovoked and illegal and all this kind of stuff. He said, oh, Bill, that was 2008. What's that? Do the math. That's just 15 years ago. You forget about that? It's all written down in his cable. We have the cable from WikiLeaks. What do you think, Bill? No. He's playing the game. And the propaganda is what often wins the game. So it's really sad. I thought, a lot of us thought that Burns, knowing what he knows, would not succumb to the propaganda operation, but that's what he's done.
There is a conflict within the Zelensky administration between Zelensky and Zeluzhny. What's the reason for this conflict?
Another good question, Nima. I think that it's a mistake to talk about the U.S. We have desperate neocons, I would say Blinken, Sullivan, and we have some voices that have some measure of rational, some reason to them. So which factions want to push this thing further, want to make sure that Ukraine stands up through the next several months and loses still more people and provokes Russia? And which faction says, it's a whole year till the election, and we ought to fish and cut bait now, okay? And so we got to get the Zelensky guy out of there, because it's not Zelensky who's delusional. it's Zelensky who's delusional. Zelensky has considerable support in the armed forces. He even, he studied in Russian or Soviet military schools. He earned a degree of respect there. he's the ideal guy to come in and say, well, you know, the military fiasco, that was this guy's fault. What's his name? Oh, yeah, Zelensky. Oh, where'd he go? He went to the Bahamas. He's got a really nice villa there. He's the guy that could do that. Now, whether they're smart enough to do that or whether they want to just up this a notch and say, well, maybe we could do a little mini nuke. I don't know. I hear myself saying that. I'm saying that's delusional, but it's no longer delusional because these people themselves are delusional. And, you know, even if there's less than a 50-50 chance that we'll go nuclear, well, what kind of comfort does that give us?
We had Janet Yellen talking about that. U.S. cannot afford Ukraine losing this war. But the question, the real question would be, can Ukraine afford this war? How many people got killed during these 18, 19 months of this war in Ukraine? Is that affordable for Ukraine? Are they considering just the U.S. benefit? How about Ukraine? How about the people of Ukraine who are suffering a lot during this war?
Well, it's the same question. How about the people in Gaza? People abroad don't matter much to the likes of Janet Yellen. She says, look, we have all the money we need. We can borrow it from the Chinese. Push is going to come to shove here. We don't have all the money we need. Matter of fact, there are increasing numbers of Americans in poverty now. We've been neglecting those folks. And that's going to come back and haunt whoever runs for president, like Biden, if he succeeds now in actually making it physically to the election. So Yellen is just one of this elite crop of people. She knows a lot about economics, but she doesn't know much about the world. Witness the fact that, you know, she was pushing this cap on the price of Russian oil. I'm not an economist, okay? But I could see that's never going to work, you know? But she was pushing it. And now they kind of say, well, okay, that didn't work. Now what are we going to do next? So there are a bunch of ideologues. I would say not so much ideology, but superiority. We're exceptional. We're indispensable, actually. And we have been able to work our will on the whole world up till now. Who says we can't keep doing that? Well, realistic people say you can't do that. There's been a tectonic shift in the relative balance of forces here. It shows itself not only in Ukraine, but it shows itself in Gaza as well. And what worries me is that if Biden decides to, well, I think he probably has already decided to say, okay, we're going to have a humanitarian genocide starting on Tuesday. Humanitarian because we let, you know, several trucks in. You saw those trucks on TV all during Thanksgiving weekend. You didn't see any Gazans being decimated. And with all the trucks, okay. So that's, we've been humanitarians now. Now we're going back to genocide. Genocide. Do not blench before the word. Being accomplices in genocide? You know, I'm old enough to have lived through one genocide. 6 million Jews genocided. There are 2 million plus Palestinians in Gaza. Does it have to be 6 million? Could be only 2 million or 1 million of those. They've already been ethnically cleansed out of the north part of Gaza. What I'm saying here is that there comes a limit to how much the surrounding Arab states, many of them with huge Palestinian populations, including Saudi Arabia, and Turkey and Iran, will watch this stuff without intervening in a more forceful way. When that happens, it's going to be really delicate because, as you know, Israel has nuclear weapons. Would they resort to that in extremis? Again, I think they probably would. And so, again, the Arab countries are playing a very careful game. I compare them to Xi Jinping and Putin. They're saying, well, we're not going to be provoked. You know, you have those aircraft carriers there. You know, as we know, that they're three soccer fields long, okay? And we could hit them, but we're not going to do that because we don't want to give you a pretext to get into this war. So how much more carnage, how much more ethnic cleansing, collective punishment, genocide, these folks in the Middle East will tolerate is unknown to me. So far, they've been very, very careful. But, you know, I just don't know what's going to happen. But I fear the worst because Austin is not a real smart guy. And putting two aircraft carriers right in the middle of the battle and putting a ballistic missile submarine in the battle, which also has cruise missile capability, it just ain't very smart because that happened in 1983 as well, 40 years ago. And of course, we know that 242 Marines were killed in those barracks outside of Beirut. What did Reagan do? He said, oh, well, let's get the hell out of Dodge. And he did. No more. There were battleships. I mean, like, whoa, two battleships firing into Syria in the Golan Heights. He said, all right, nothing ventured, nothing gained. Let's get the hell out of there. And 242 Marines is a big price to pay for that kind of thing. What's going to happen when those 900 U.S. forces in the north of Syria get decimated by terrorist groups, okay, supported by Iran? Well, there are people in the U.S. administration who would really like to see that happen. Really like to see that happen. But then they will have a pretext to go after Iran. Does Netanyahu like that? Yeah, he likes the idea too. He's been trying to get American presidents to go after Iran for decades, okay? And the last thing I'll say is this. It's questionable now. I spoke at a demonstration here in Raleigh, North Carolina yesterday. I looked out at 1,000 people. It's a little town, Raleigh. 1,000 people there, and many of them with the shawls and all that kind of stuff, okay? And I said, I look out here and I see young people. I joked and I said, you know, having me up here brings the average age from 25 to 30, you know? And I said, this is the key. This is the key because young people are going to make the difference here. And so Bibi Netanyahu, not knowing he was being videotaped, in 2001 said this: we're going to make it so painful, we're going to create such chaos for the Palestinians, they'll have to realize they have to kowtow and get at it. Okay. And one woman says, well, Mr. Netanyahu, won't the world accuse us of being occupiers? And he said, oh, it doesn't matter what the world accuses us of. He says, listen, and please listen, quote, we know what the Americans think. The American people support us 80%. It's absurd, end quote, chuckle, 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 chuckle. So 80%, it's absurd. 2001. Is it 80% now? No, I think it's more like about 40%. You won't see it from the headlines in the Washington Post today or CNN. That's different. But people are beginning to glom onto the fact that they're not getting the right story. The Washington Post has an article talking about how Israeli women were raped. There's a warning. Please be careful, because this is very, very disgusting stuff, or whatever they say, okay? And then they go chapter and verse. It's like a gory, I mean, they explain how it does it, what the blood and where the blood was and all that stuff. Now, that is the epitome of propaganda, okay? Now, the Washington Post says, you know, this is a tragedy of war. No, it's a tragedy of propaganda, because this is the last straw. They pull it all out. This is the, what do you call it? The in a basketball game, it's the end of the game. The end of the game challenge to make sure that the full press wins. Okay, so that's what's happening in the media, and Joe Biden will probably not do anything when Netanyahu on Tuesday resumes the humanitarian genocide. You see a oxymoron there? Well, I certainly do. More and more Americans, particularly young Americans, particularly people who, you know, can put two and two together and don't watch CNN and don't believe the Washington Post anymore. So Biden's going to have a crisis on his hands if, and I hope he doesn't, you know, if he doesn't restrain, I hope he does restrain, but I don't expect him to restrain Netanyahu and say, okay, well, we will support you 100%, just as we always have, because 80% of the American, well, wait a second, is it 80% anymore? He'll consult with his advisor. No, it's down to 40% now. What are we going to do? Maybe he'll wake up. I don't think he's capable of waking up, but maybe his advisors will wake up and say, well, enough is enough. We got to rein these people in before we get involved in a wider war in the Middle East, as well as the one in Ukraine, and as well as the one that threatens because of what we're doing in the Pacific against China.
When you look at the Netanyahu administration, keep talking about, we have to win this conflict. We have to win this war against Gazans, against Palestinians. But when it comes to the meaning of winning, what does it mean? Do you think that with the current behavior that the Netanyahu administration is committing in Gaza, do you see any winning for them politically or militarily?
No. And that's the long-term trend here. People have to realize that the constellation of forces has changed. The Arab countries and Turkey and Iran are not going to let Israel continue the genocide. Now, when I say genocide, that's exactly what I mean. This is a textbook case. So if they think they can win through a genocide, if they think they can destroy another million Palestinians having emigrated from North Gaza to South Gaza, you know, I think they have another think coming, because I think the Palestinian people in these surrounding countries will rise up and say, now that's enough. You guys talk a good game. Why don't you help our brothers and sisters in Palestine? And then it's push is going to come to shove, because Iran, Turkey, even Hezbollah in southern Lebanon have lots of missiles and sophisticated weaponry that they didn't have before that can decimate Israel without any nuclear weapon. Okay. So they have a deterrent already. But as long as Israel thinks it can depend on the United States of America, there's going to be bedlam and worse. That's what we have to realize. Both Bibi Netanyahu and Joe Biden depend on the support of the American people in the last instance. And I applaud my co-members of Jewish Voice for Peace and other people who get out now with and demonstrate and say, look, we're with you, you young people. This is not going to persist. And when you read about all those rapes in the Washington Post, well, just realize that that's the epitome. That's the full court press. Lest Biden soften on genocide. Yeah, again, don't believe me about genocide. I've exchanged email with Richard Falk, eminent lawyer, international lawyer, and he spelled out. He said, you know, this is a textbook case. So if we're not up to dealing with genocide, we Americans who are enabling the genocide, who could stop it? By telling Netanyahu, knock it off, you don't have our support anymore. So that's a pretty heavy burden to bear. And if we don't try to do something about it, well, somebody said the only thing necessary for evil to succeed is for good people to do nothing. Or too many of us are doing nothing. Maybe this will be a catalyst to doing something for justice. Justice for those Palestinians who have suffered for 75 years and now are suffering just as it did in the beginning.
There is an article in Politico. It says that Europe should offer Trump a Ukraine deal. He can't refuse. It seems that they're assuming that Trump will win this election, the 2024 election. Europe has to offer a good deal for Trump that he cannot back down on the Ukraine war. Is Europe capable of doing that? Are they willing to do that?
Nima, I don't know. Politico, of course, is a checkered source for anything. It surfaces ideas that are running around in Washington. I think it's premature to speculate on what Trump will do. My God, who knows what he'll do? I would hate to be a betting man and have to bet on what he'd do. And I think it still is questionable as to whether he will win whatever election, the election that comes up a year from now. I think that the operative facts here are that everybody's afraid that he'll win. And everybody will do whatever they can to prevent him from winning, like they did last time. Now, I hope they do legal things, not making stuff up like Russiagate or like being in Putin's pocket, all that kind of stuff, Russian hacking. That's fair game. Do what you can legally. And I think there are enough American people to say that if you just look at what happened on January 6th, after the 2020 election, January 6th, 2021, you could see a person who I would suggest is not worthy of obeying the Constitution, and therefore should never be anywhere near the presidency. One hope that I have, of course, is that Jill Stein has entered the race. I know Jill. I supported her. No money, but I gave her many briefings back in 2016. And she stands for a lot of what I believe to be the case, to be true. So it's just really, really salutary to have a person that you can say, whoa, somebody else is in the race. And let's not be diverted by people who say, oh, she's a spoiler. She can never win. Yeah, they've said that a lot of people. They said that about Trump, for God's sake. So let's just see. Let's have a healthy debate. And let's beware of the kind of tricks that happened in 2016 and, sorry to say, 2020 as well, both by the Democrats. The two parties are equally corrupt. Now, somebody was saying to me, this is kind of fun. Oh, China, one party, you know, dictatorship. We have two parties. The Chinese specialist said to me, yeah, Ray, think about that. One party in China able to make various policies in consultation with a healthy percentage of the people, actually sensible policies for China, whereas compared with the US, you got two parties, but one policy. One policy born of this idea that we're exceptional and that we can work our will anywhere in the world. Delusional. What's it? Delusionally? No, this is delusional, and it's going to come back to bite us unless young people stand up and say, no, enough of that stuff. Realize the world has changed. It's been a tectonic shift. You have Russia and China against you. I mean, a big deal. Even Brzezinski and Kissinger said that was really stupid. Okay. So we have to be put in our place. And I hope that people are smart enough, Americans are smart enough, to realize that that place is a far different place than the one we're used to, the one we're told that we can be exceptional, that as Joe Biden says about China, China aspires to be the most powerful country in the world. That's not going to happen on my watch. That's the first thing he said about China after being elected. Well, what's wrong with that? I mean, hello, can't we? I mean, the Chinese talk about a win-win situation, and they're still talking about it, thank goodness. Because if the wrong kind of people came to power in China or in Russia, it would be a very tense, even more tense international situation where we just couldn't cope with it. With the armed forces that we have now, we could do a lot of damage, but we would take a lot of damage in return. And it would be damage within this country as well. And I'm not talking just about terrorism. So the earlier people wake up to the fact that our hegemony, that the notion that we should lead the world, well, that's defunct. We ought to just sit back and say, okay, well, there are other countries in the world. If they don't pretend to be exceptional, let's knock it off. Let's be just a regular country like the others and share the riches that are in store for all of us. There's enough for everyone, okay? Just have to do a better proportion, especially for the people. And the people, the orphans, the widows, the refugees, about which the Abrahamic tradition is very, very clear, deserved preference. That's their concept of justice, preference for the poor. And we're a long way from this right now, but I have hope that this incredibly dangerous time will evolve in such a way that people keep their heads, people, Russia, China, hopefully some people within the United States, that we avoid the worst, and that this time next year we'll be looking forward to a different kind of world, mostly because we have a different kind of administration in Washington. We'll have to see.
How do you find RFK Jr.? He has changed a lot. What has happened to him, in your opinion?
Well, Denis Kucinich is a friend of mine. I admire him greatly. I couldn't understand why he could hang around when RFK Jr. said those stupid things about Israel, Palestine. In the event, he didn't hang around. He quit. Now, I haven't talked to him, or I haven't ever heard from him, but I believe he quit over this issue. This is a supremely important issue. It has to do with justice. And I, too, had some initial enthusiasm for RFK Jr. But if he's so off base, if he's so wrong on this one, well, I wrote to his new campaign advisor and said, look, unless he changes, I'm not going to send any more material to you to help educate you. You're far gone, okay? I never got a response. So, yeah, it's an extreme, extreme disappointment because, as you say, the other things you stand for mostly are really the right things, and he stands for them with some background and vehemence. But you can't be wrong. You can't be this wrong on this cardinal issue and still deserve trust. And did I compare it to Obama? You know, when Obama had decided to run, he was still a senator, of course, you know, and the egregious behavior of the telecoms, the giant telecommunications companies, corporations in our country, had become revealed that they were keeping book on all our telephone conversations and sharing them with the government, all this business, okay? It was really bad. And Senator Obama got up and said, I'm going to hold the telecoms responsible for this. Okay. Whoops. Then all of a sudden, John Brennan, who later became Obama's CIA chief, John Brennan joined his campaign about June 2008, I guess. Huh? When was it? Yeah. Okay. So he joins the campaign, and all of a sudden, Senator Obama gets up. It was sort of like the 30th of June, or first part of July, and he says, you know, I've changed my mind. I'm not going to hold the telecommunications corporations responsible. I think they're doing a great job saving us from terrorism and all that kind of stuff. A light went off in his head, you know, and I said, I wrote an article. I said, well, Obama, you've lost this intelligence analyst. You can't be faithful in this key issue. Your opinions are going to be changing to fit in with the deep state. Well, that may help you win the election, but I'm not going to support you anymore. Now, did I vote for Obama? Yeah. The lesser evil approach, right? But these people really are so malleable, so willing to be deceived on key issues. This was a key issue. And so, of course, was the one we just mentioned. So I just say that people need to be able to hold these people to account, ask them questions. And when they disappear from the reason and the logic of the situation, like RFK has on Israel, well, you know, the question, of course, is whether he's stupid or whether he's crassly political on this issue. I don't know which it is, but either of them doesn't speak well for him. And I'll limit my remarks to that. I see Jill Stein as being one of the most courageous and well-informed, and you know, her politics, her approach to foreign affairs, which of course is my dish, is much more reasonable and courageous than the other candidates, such as they are now.